The psychedelic revolution is here. If you want to integrate your visionary experiences into your purpose, get clear on your entrepreneurial path, and help people while you do what you love, then this podcast is for you. Welcome to The Psychedelic Entrepreneur, Medicine for These Times. I'm your host, Beth Weinstein. I'm a spiritual business coach, three-time entrepreneur, and a lifelong student of psychedelics and sacred plant medicines. You carry your own unique medicine, and your medicine is what we need for these times. This podcast will help you to share your medicine so you can create transformation in the world. Listen in on conversations with psychedelic leaders, changemakers, and conscious entrepreneurs who are living proof that a better world is possible when you follow your heart and live in alignment with your soul. Welcome back to The Psychedelic Entrepreneur. Today, I am presenting Daniel Cleland from Soltara Healing Center, the CEO. Hi, Daniel. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Beth. Pleasure to finally meet you.
Good to meet you. And Daniel's coming to us from what I would love to consider my second home, Costa Rica, one of the most beautiful places on the planet. So Daniel is CEO of Soltara Healing Center, which gained worldwide recognition in 2019 as the preeminent Shipibo Healing Center outside Peru, and is now regularly visited by the most prominent influencers, celebrities, and public figures. One of the patrons includes Logan Mader, who he met backstage at a concert in 2020 when he expressed interest in an ayahuasca retreat at Soltara. Shortly after meeting, Daniel founded the now internationally acclaimed band Savage Existence and Mader produced their debut album, Animals. Since then, the Savage Existence has toured with iconic acts like Sepultura, Monstrosity, and more, and is working on their second album coming out this year in 2023. Daniel holds a master's of intercultural and international communication, but he learned his hard knock style of scaling from years of traveling, living, and hustling in the merciless Amazon jungles of South America. He is often referred to as the Indiana Jones of entrepreneurship. After applying the principles in this book to his company, his band, and everywhere he sets his sights, Daniel's new book, The 12 Laws of the Jungle, How to Become a Lethal Entrepreneur, has been called You Must Have Machete for the Jungle of Entrepreneurship. I can't wait to get into that. The foreword was written by Patrick Bet David of Valuetainment.
Okay, great.
And the book lays out the 12 laws Daniel learned while living in the Peruvian jungle and how they are necessary for every entrepreneur to understand how to survive and thrive in the unforgiving jungle of entrepreneurship. I do want to apologize that I've been a little under the weather for the last few weeks, so please forgive me and some blips. But Daniel, what an amazing story. I love that you're speaking about the jungle of entrepreneurship, because I personally am always saying entrepreneurship is like a gigantic ayahuasca ceremony that just seems to never end. But what's your story? You know, you lived down in the jungle. I would love to hear about that. But, you know, what got you started? And I'm curious, you know, even as a young child, like, were you already on some kind of seeking path, or, you know, what was your original career and how did you end up, you know, founding and running Soltara?
Yes. Okay. Geez, that's a strange bio. the PR firm did that. It sounds weird when I hear it, but anyways, yeah. So, like most people, okay, like we're kind of talking about two different streams here. You know, considering the title of your podcast, The Psychedelic Entrepreneur, there's a psychedelic aspect and the entrepreneur's aspect, and of course, you know, one of my current startup battles right now is the band that we're building, right? Which is just, it's a whole different type of can of worms in and a business in itself. So that, you know, we talked a little bit about that in the book. And even a book is a business too, but, strictly speaking, I got into ayahuasca and into entrepreneurship for similar reasons, mainly being that I was just completely and utterly unhappy in my life. And this was in 2000, 9. Well, I suppose, you know, the kind of for a few years, I really struggled to find the right job or, you know, the right career path. I wanted to help the world, but, you know, I made some mistakes earlier on in life, which prevented me from securing some of the career options I wanted, you know, when back in the day when you needed a 4-year education and, I had fun kind of adventuring in my 20s and traveling, working in tourism and stuff like that. But I reached a bit of a crisis point when I was getting close to 30 years old. And just realized that any of these like perfect, you know, I was, while trying to find the perfect job, it was just never something that materialized, because perfect jobs don't exist, right? You're, you know, for someone who wants to adventure and travel and have lots of free time and also have the money to do things, you know, the code word for job is just over broke, right? They keep you on the hamster wheel, with enough leeway to pay your bills and spend your money getting drunk to, you know, forget your problems on the weekend. So I kind of got to this crisis point, and that also materialized in me making some pretty dumb decisions because of I was getting really drunk on the weekends. And one of those weekends, I decided to climb a 60-foot cliff and fell off and almost died for what? And then, you know, but compound fracture the femur, so big bone sticking out of my leg, split my pelvis in half, and ended up spending 40 days in a hospital in Australia. With like an exoskeleton screwed into my body and $40,000 hospital bill with no insurance. While I was in that hospital, with my life completely in the toilet, turning 30, no girl wanted to associate with me. I had no money. I had no idea what I was going to do with my life. And the first thing I needed to do was fix what was, you know, the emotional distress that I was under. So that's when I decided to get involved with ayahuasca, just on a personal level. So I made a call from the hospital bed and I decided to quit my endeavors in Australia, and I found ayahuasca, long story short, which really helped me kind of clean out some of the emotional baggage that I was carrying, some of the self-contempt and self-judgment, just internally begin to fix some of the things that were holding me back in life from a spiritual and emotional perspective. And then shortly thereafter, I got a little bit more serious about a career scenario and started learning that the only way I was going to get ahead in a career scenario was by entrepreneurship. I bought a book called The 4-Hour Work Week and I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad actually while I was in Australia. So I started to learn how the world actually works, you know, between the cash flow quadrant, the employee versus the business owner versus employee versus self-employed versus business owner versus investor. And started taking some interest in working my way around that cash flow quadrant. So once I made that decision, I basically just kind of pasted together the things I was passionate about with the things I was good at. And I had gathered some experience leading tours in my 20s in South America. I spoke half decent Spanish and half decent Portuguese. And I loved South America. I loved the beaches, the jungles. And I was very passionate about ayahuasca. And I also wanted to subsidize my own work deepening with the medicine. The only way I could do that was by taking groups of people down to the Amazon and designing these tours and going to drink ayahuasca in the Amazon. So I did that. I started a small business, and while I spent the years 2012 to 2014 studying a master's degree part-time while working a sales job full-time and building my business at the same time, bootstrapping with my own kind of investing my own paychecks and writing my own web copy and managing my own website and all that kind of stuff. I managed to get busy enough with my little budding business that I quit my last job in 2013. And next thing you knew, I had built an ayahuasca center in the Amazon, which is where I lived from, 2014 until 2017. Then I sold that and came and built Soltara in Costa Rica.
Oh my God. Incredible story. Well, let's dive into this. I'm curious, because this has been a huge part of my journey, and I actually have a very similar story about, just going through the grind, being on the hamster wheel just so I could afford to live. But then my living involved just getting wasted to then be able to deal with the job, right? And it was like being on that wheel, and I'm like, wait, is this what I'm really supposed to do the rest of my life? Because that's essentially what my parents did too. And I saw that pattern repeating. And like you, it was 2013 when I walked away and have never looked back ever since. But I'm curious, when you first went to work with ayahuasca and you're in this kind of this place in your life of like openness and also like utter destruction energy. I'm curious, how has the medicine affected, this path, like even before, let's say leading the retreats, like, did you start getting insights on, oh, hey, I want to one day have a center or one day bring groups? Like, I'm curious, did your career path from that point forward come through the medicine? And if so, I'm curious, like, how did it or didn't it?
I had zero interest in business or ayahuasca before I found myself in a point of complete crisis in my life. I was dead set on working in some type of environmental profession. Like I had, I traveled, I spent a couple of years leading group tours around South America. So I actually started in Costa Rica and Panama, and then went down, was working for G Adventures. So like 15 people groups, destination over the course of weeks. My longest trip was 6 weeks, 59 days. But so I worked in Costa Rica and Panama, and then I went down and started running this this massive trip from Caracas, Venezuela, down into northern Brazil, then down the Amazon River to the Brazilian coast and all across the Brazilian coast, and then terminating in Rio de Janeiro. And I did that a few times, going from the top of South America to the bottom of South America. The last time I went all the way down from Caracas all the way down to Buenos Aires, Argentina. And I just saw, like, before going down and traveling all that territory, and I'm talking like the barrios and like, the remote beaches that were covered in, plastic and fishing nets. And like, just, I thought it was just kind of this paradise. And then I realized that there was a lot of social environmental problems down there. And I wanted to do something to help. I was always growing up in Canada, always like kind of environmentally oriented and really loved nature and the forests and things like that. So I wanted to go, and I tried to do this program called Natural Resources Conservation at UBC, but I didn't have the marks. When I was younger, I partied pretty hard in college and high school, and just, my priority was mostly just having fun and, meeting girls and making friends and playing heavy metal and stuff like that. So I didn't have the qualifications to get into the environmental program I wanted. So I went back to college when I was 27, and I took a bunch of high school courses over again in the college. I did a bunch of university level courses in the college to get like my marks up so that I could get into the program I wanted. But then my sense of adventure got the best of me, and I took a field trip to Australia after the first year of doing that, and then everything just fell off the rails, and that's where I ended up staying in Australia because I wanted to continue going to school in Australia. I found a program. I got accepted. It was this like environmental studies program or something at James Cook University in Townsville, Queensland. And so I get to Australia this field trip and I'm like, okay, I'm going to make a go of this. I took a sales job, which is door-to-door sales job. I made pretty good cash in the first week, but then it just kind of started to deteriorate after that. So I found myself right back in the hamster wheel, working with just enough money to pay the bills and get drunk on the weekends. But my dreams of going to school it wasn't going to happen. You know, I needed to make an extra, like, I don't know, $50,000 a year to be able to go to school there. So I found myself just kind of stuck again, and really disappointed in myself for falling off the track. But I was still, you know, like if I wanted to get into entrepreneurship, that I would have done it in that job, because the whole aspect of that job was like, you know, learn how to sell this shit and then hire guys to work under you, manage them, and then you make all the money. But I was like anti-capitalist. I'm like, you know, I don't want money. I want to help the environment. I don't want to participate in the system. I want to help the environment, et cetera, et cetera. So I had zero interest in entrepreneurship, or, you know, ayahuasca. Now, that being said, I had many really meaningful experiences with psychedelics before them, with mushrooms or with LSD, for example. So I understood that psychedelics could be somewhat of a sacrament or a spiritual experience. So I was attracted to ayahuasca, but I was also afraid of it because, you know, back in those days, like this is 2009, you would read the stories about ayahuasca. It was like this crazy psychedelic that makes you vomit and confront all your demons and all this kind of stuff. So it wasn't until I actually got in front of it and had my very first ceremony that it just completely, it was like, wow, just opened me right up. And I just made so much progress in that first ceremony, which was good because I only had one ceremony. I traveled from Victoria, BC to Albuquerque, New Mexico, to Gila, New Mexico, over a weekend to do one ceremony. And so it was obviously a short time, but that was really, really strong, really powerful. And it just made me want to like continue and do more of that and learn more about that. I just became completely obsessed with ayahuasca. So, yeah. And then it was just like, how do I do more of this? I have no money. And so it was just, you know, earn money and then do more of that. And then I ended up I started reading books about entrepreneurship at that time. And the 4-hour work week was like, you know, talking about stuff like copywriting and blah, 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 blah. And so I ended up offering to do some copywriting, and blogging for an ayahuasca center in 2010, in exchange for a month-long dieta. So I went down there in 2010, did that, got more experience, got more obsessed, learned how to do copywriting, learned how to do blogging, and then just, you know, went back and made more money. I was actually working on fishing boats in the Pacific Ocean at that time, as a fisheries observer. So kind of got into the environmental field a little bit, but was just super obsessed about, I was just getting ideas, like working with ayahuasca started opening up all this creativity for me. And I was getting visions and ideas and started, you know, like especially spending weeks on end without drinking alcohol because of the dieta, was just all these like creative juices were flowing. So I started doing, you know, journaling and doing designs and stuff like that. And I came up with an idea for my own type of center that I wanted to build in Brazil. So I went back and made some more money and then moved down to Brazil and did some English teaching. But, and, you know, I tried to build the center, but my very first attempt at building a business failed. I didn't have enough experience. I didn't have any money to invest. I didn't have any business experience. So it didn't work out. And then I ended up going back to Vancouver and getting a sales job. And again, and doing, you know, doing upgrading my education. I was able to take the life experience I had, plus the marks I got in that 1 year of school I did when I was 27. And I got into a master's program, which allowed me to do it after work. So I spent those 2 years like upgrading my education, which helped me to raise a small amount of capital for my business. And also getting a brand set up and getting traction and actually doing the business and proving some demand and showing that there was, that I knew what I was doing. And then also, you know, just earning the money to kind of invest and build up and have some skin in the game all helped me get some qualifications for that first little bit of capital that I raised for that business.
Incredible. Thank you so much for sharing. Now, you also said you lived in the jungle. Was that just setting up the retreat center, the original one? And what was that like? Because I know there's a lot of people who step onto this path who have this fantasy, right, of like opening a healing center. I can't tell you how many times I hear that this is people's ultimate goals, which, you know, on some level I understand. It's like we all want to help each other heal. And when you step onto this and you realize the power, but then there's a lot of realities to it, especially when you're going to do it down in a place like Peru or Brazil or literally in the jungle where it's a whole different world. What was that like? And also, you know, I think I know your lineage that you work with at Solterra, and because they're interconnected to one of the lineages that I work with. How did you find your teachers and establish yourself down in the jungle to build a retreat center?
Yes, well, you're totally right. Peru was extremely annoying to do business in and very difficult, very rugged, very dirty, very corrupt. I was there for 4 years and I didn't have one Peruvian friend that I could trust. I mean, I had a couple of employees that were trustworthy, not many. And, you know, I just couldn't trust anybody. There was one guy who I thought, you know, was kind of like my right-hand man. And then he almost like, well, he, let's call it sexual misconduct. And, you know, I couldn't believe like three girls on the same retreat. And I was like, bro, what are you doing, man? So I had to fire him. And I just couldn't believe you put the whole, after everything we've been through, put the whole operation at risk. And then, yeah, I mean, there's other guys who worked for me. Like I just couldn't trust anybody. I got scammed so many times. I at the end of it, I hated walking through town because everybody just trying to get something from me, you know?
Iquitos, was it?
Yeah. I can't stand Iquitos. No. I'll never go back there in my life. No. So yeah, there's that. And then of course, you know, if you can't speak Spanish and you don't know business, don't even try. Like, I mean, the healing center business is still a business, right? And there's not everybody's benevolent, and there's healers who get jealous and they shoot poison darts through the spiritual realm at you. And there's, you know, there's competition between other centers and people talk shit about you. And I mean, it's still a business. You still have to make payroll. You still have to keep the company profitable. You know, you still need to navigate banks and wire transfers and payments and legalities and compliance and, you know, HR, like everything like that. It's still a huge can of worms. So, you know, most people who start businesses shouldn't start businesses. And so, you know, like I think naturally being a little bit of a cutthroat has helped me survive, in the business when things get tough. like during the pandemic, for example, or in this, just in the startup phase, or when, you know, you have to make hard decisions that piss a few people off. You know, it's, you just have to be confident and a little bit tough. Yeah, what was the other question you asked?
Well, let me ask a question related to what you talk about, because I hear this a lot. You know, like I've done 4 summits about medicine and purpose and conscious entrepreneurship and how it can awaken us to this path. And then I get this criticism, which, by the way, is the small minority. It's like a very small group of people who say, these are plants. They're from the earth. They should just be free.
Well, they are free. If you want to go down to the fucking, pardon my French, if you want to go down to the Amazon, pick them yourself, boil them yourself, and drink them yourself, they're free. The minute you get other people to help you, they're not free.
I know.
Right? And your flight to get down there is definitely not free. And your boat to get in the middle of the Amazon, not free. And where you're probably staying is not going to be free. But, you know, I hear that. I'm just like, you're so clueless, you know? There's lots of ways.
I would say try making ayahuasca, which I've done a few times, and it's no joke. Like pounding by hand, every little, you know.
Yeah, and then like if you want to actually do it in a place that costs, you know, millions of dollars to build, that costs hundreds of thousands of dollars to run every year, with people who have spent 10 to 15 years of their lives investing their own money and learning their trade, that have all kinds of options. You know, people, some of them have kids, like they need to fly too. They need to get around the world. They need to pay rent somewhere. They need to eat good food. People just don't do stuff for free, you know? And, I had to raise $2.5 million to build Zoltara. Those people did not get that money for free, right? They got that money by working very hard, and they're trying to, you know, retire someday. And the reason they work so hard to get that money is that so they could, you know, get some interest off of it when they loan it to people, you know, like there's just so many, the people who say that are so utterly clueless about how life actually works. You know, and I would just say, okay, go do it yourself then. You want to go do it for free, go raise money, go spend years of your life fighting through the startup battle to get a sustainable organization, dealing with all these people trying to screw you over, dealing with employees, you know, like dealing with banks, dealing with lawyers, and then tell me if you still want to offer your services for free. And I can guarantee 100% of the time it will be definitely not. And sorry for being such an idiot. You know,
I know. I'm glad you bring this up, because I have a copy and paste response that I've sent to people, because there's also this, you know, I assume people who say this to me have never been into the trenches of the jungle, where there's actual communities that live in the middle of nowhere amongst tarantulas and snakes and, you know, but then they have this vision that they're all just living off the land in harmony with the earth. And I'm like, no, there's motorcycles and gas and tuk-tuks and noise and garbage, and there's still food at the shops and clothing. And, you know, it's not like they're just living in these huts that are, you know, I mean, there are also, some.
Guess what? Those people who live in the jungle like to shoot cute monkeys and cute sloths, yeah, and eat them. Like, you know, yeah, like they're not all good people down, yeah, there, you know, yeah, and, you know, it's rough and rugged. I opened my new book by saying that, you know, the jungle will kill you within 48 hours if, you know, if you don't know what you're doing. Like it's a rough, rough place. And the people who live there are rough people. Some of them, you know, carry guns. And yep. Some of them, you know, rape women, and some young women that are underage. And like, you know, there's like, it's, yep, it's not a fairy tale, right? It's not a fairy tale. And even when you get into the medicine space, some of the healers are not benevolent, you know, even within just, like you can even have healers within the same ayahuasca center that are shooting things like, you know, attacking each other and between other centers, and you can have brujeria and you can have people cursing each other and stuff like that. You know, it's just not a, it's not a fairy tale. You know, it's very powerful. And if you find the right people, and you're in the, you know, the, and it's not only, it's the right people. Yes. But it's also the right, like, circle of people, because if, like, if you have a circle of people that work well together and like trust each other and there's a certain vibe that they have together, then that's, you know, that's a safe space. But if you have like some of the best people, but then there's ego battles between them, and like you're just walking into this like crossfire, like that can also be dangerous. So yeah, I mean, yeah, it's an interesting world, that's for sure.
Well, yeah, let's get into it a little, because I want to talk about the realities of running a retreat center. Because, you know, again, there's a lot of glorification of this. I've interviewed a few other people and friends with people that own other retreat centers, and everybody has the same stories of like, you know, there's a lot of realistic challenges, you know, especially when you try to scale or expand. And then also when it comes to the pricing, you know, there's this criticism like, well, it's only for people, you know, a certain class of people that can afford to pay $5,000 to sit with medicine, you know. So, you know, what do you say to that? And how does, you know, your business model potentially serve more and more people and help this grand, you know, like the demand for healing, while also making it, you know, like accessible to some or not accessible? Like, do you have, you know, ways of dealing with that or handling that or building it into the future of the business?
Yeah, for sure. So, so there's lots to be said about that. First, you know, there's all different kinds of price points across the board. It really comes down to how comfortable do you want to be? How many people do you want to have around you while you're doing it? And how good do you want those people to be? And how much work do you actually want to put in yourself? Right? If you want to put all the work in yourself, you learn Spanish, you take a flight down to Peru, you take a bus to Pucallpa, you take a peque-peque up the river, and you sit in a village with some shipibos, and you eat rice and eggs and chicken that they slaughter, that, you know, that runs around, free-range chicken. You know, and you'll drink really powerful medicine, and they'll, you know, hopefully take care of you without causing you any problems. That's the cheapest way to do it, right? It's also not the safest. You're also not going to have people around you who speak English, you know, and it's not going to be comfortable. There's going to be mosquitoes. You're going to be sleeping on a crappy bed with, you know, open air, no air conditioning. Probably get diarrhea because the water's not going to be good. You know, it's just that's the reality. If you want to go to Costa Rica, to a place like Soltara, and, you know, we have a 2-to-1 staff to guest ratio. You know, we have some of the most talented people and experienced people working with you. We've developed a fully integrative, like, Western informed therapeutic program to go with it. We have amazing food with, you know, great chefs, 21 acre beachfront property, you know, with sunrise view. All the rooms are, you know, 50 meters, 500 square feet, with luxury king beds and luxury linens and, you know, marble countertops and nice stone showers, you know, like with nice transportation, like just all that stuff in Costa Rica makes it $5,000 a week. So we get a different demographic. Now, even that being said, we have a couple of more rustic. And another thing is we have maximum group size of 22 people. So, you know, we have to make that place viable with 22 people a week. So we have to make it that comfortable so that people are willing to pay that much so that we can support the operational costs and not go under and be able to survive a hiccup like the pandemic if one happens. That being said, we have a couple of more rustic options on site that are a lower price point. We also have shared rooms, which are a lower price point. And we also have a scholarship where we take, you know, I think one or two people for free every month. I'm not sure what that is. And then in addition to that, we opened up another center in Peru. So everything in Costa Rica is really expensive, as you know. Like, I mean, it's basically American prices here. Very expensive in Costa Rica. It's very nice, beautiful country. It's safe. It's convenient, easy to get to, you know, 3 hours from Miami. Like it's like there's reasons why Costa Rica is expensive. And then, you know, Peru's much cheaper. And there's also reasons why Peru's cheaper. Much more inconvenient, much less safe, farther, harder to get to, you know. So, you know, we just recently opened up another center in Peru this year that's rustic. It's in the Amazon. It's half the price of our Costa Rican operations, you know, small groups as well, 13 max people, you know. So you just get what you pay for, you know. And if you really want to do it cheap, you can do it. And if you really want to be comfortable and safe and convenient and have all kinds of hands-on care and pampering and luxury, you can do that too. It just costs money.
And I'm glad you bring this up because I've actually done both. I've had the both extremes. Like when I do dietas in the jungle, it's open air tambos. And, you know, thankfully I'm with a good crew that I trust that I've been working with for a long time. But it's no joke. I mean, the first time I went there, it was like the amount of anxiety because it's just so intense. And yeah, there's guys that walk around with guns because I was like, oh, why are there guys walking around with guns? You know, oh, well, we have to guard you guys. I didn't know it was like that until I'm in that reality. And it's definitely not for everyone. You know, I always say my mom would never go drink medicine like that. But would my mom maybe go to Soltara? Not in this lifetime, but she would, you know what I mean? Or someone that needs like a more comfortable environment or is just not ready to be immersed sleeping 3 inches away from tarantulas. So thank you for bringing this up. And I love to shed, you know, a lot of light on the reality of what it's like to run these centers. You know, you mentioned being profitable, having to stay in business. People forget that there is an actual staff, you know, for safety reasons as well, and also to maximize what you're there for, you know, the healing, the experience. You know, it's not just a vacation here. It's a very different experience. Now, you know, I want to talk a little bit about this book you wrote and what lethal entrepreneurship is like. And, you know, you mentioned the jungle and entrepreneurship, which I love this because I always speak about how I believe entrepreneurship is very similar to this psychedelic experience of, you know, riding the waves of the ups and downs and the, you know, wanting it to just end, but there's 5 more hours left, you know, like, and what is this all about? And can you explain this, you know, the Indiana Jones piece of it?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I'm a wartime entrepreneur. Right. I discovered this when building the companies. Right. When you're in the startup battle, I tend to feel like it's an assault. Like I'm like, you know, you're constantly you're being attacked. You're constantly on edge. It's like the 1,000-yard stare. It's like, OK, what's coming next? You know, and so I've done that enough times. I've started 3 businesses, and one of them is Soltara. One of them was the business Pulse that I started in Peru, and one of them was a company I started in Texas, which didn't succeed. But well, kind of did. We sold it for basically break even, but. It feels like you're being attacked, and you know when you're being attacked, you have to fight back, and you have to neutralize threats basically. So whether that threat is low cash flow, you know, you can't make payroll every month, that's a threat, because if you don't pay people, they're going to leave, And so how do you know, you've got to fix that somehow. You need to increase sales, or you need to increase prices, or you need to cut costs or something like that. You know, there's, I've been betrayed by people multiple times. I've been legally attacked by people. I've had bank accounts just close down my accounts because I can't provide a certain piece of paper, or they don't like the piece of paper I provide, or I didn't provide it in time, or like, you know, we've had various payment platforms and, you know, wire transfer services close our accounts because they didn't, you know, they changed their policy guidelines, or they didn't like ayahuasca or whatever. Just when you are just a hair's breadth away from total collapse, and you need to keep all the wheels on the bus, and you're constantly under attack, you must be lethal or you will not survive. That is why, you know, the vast majority of businesses do not last 3 years, let alone 5 years, let alone 10 years, right? 90 some percent of businesses do not last 10 years. And so, you know, you have to, first you have to fight through the startup war to get to a certain place of stability, which I refer to as peacetime in the book. And that's, you know, that's when you've got, a kick-ass team of people that's happy, that's been with you for a while. You've got your ride or dies, you've got enough resources in the bank to be able to weather, you know, a hiccup, like which I call hiccup capital in the book, which, you know, who knows what that could be next. It was the pandemic was obviously one thing that just all of a sudden, like, today we're killing it. Oh, wait, tomorrow the borders are closed and we don't know when they're going to open again. Like, whoever knew that could happen, right? What's the next thing? World War III, you know, another pandemic. There's
lockdowns.
Who knows what could happen? So you have to, but you have to be ready for that. So you get to a certain point where you've got enough cushion in the bank to weather any potential storm, you know, market downturns, whatever. And you can kind of, you know, take a breather and put someone else in charge who's more peacetime oriented, which is, you know, kind of soft and smoother and more like networking and massaging things and optimizing things and making small tweaks here and there to optimize operations or optimize, you know, profitability or HR, things like that, which all is just really boring to me. I find myself more in the way of like, okay, start something and go to battle kind of thing. So, you know, that's the whole lethal entrepreneur concept, is really just getting the kills that you need to keep the organization alive. Cause really you're the ultimate point of accountability. When you're an entrepreneur, you start a business, you have no one else to blame except for yourself. And if you take your eyes off the ball, or if you get, complacent, or if you let things slide in the organization and you're not like kind of looking at the business chessboard and contemplating 5, 10, 15 moves ahead and how every action that happens has kind of a chain reaction that goes throughout your business, then that's your fault. And if your business collapses because you missed something, that's your fault. So, so, you know, you really have to, take that seriously. And, if you see something going on, you just have to be lethally effective. And I don't obviously mean lethally by like actually killing or hurting anybody, but you have to, be decisive, right? And the whole like Indiana Jones saying, it's kind of stupid, but yeah, no, just a guy who is following my whole journey, who runs a podcast, you know, I kind of like became an entrepreneur by like, you know, cruising up the Amazon River in, you know, little dugout canoes and like, you know, taking people on jungle tours and drinking psychedelics in the middle of the jungle with indigenous shamans and stuff like that. So it's kind of like, I mean, I built my business on adventure, right? I mean, that was really, I was all about adventure when I was in my 20s and probably the first half of my 30s. I got pretty tired of it by the time I was 35, and that's when I moved up to Costa Rica, and I've been slowly just getting more and more interested in comfort and being a little bit more chill since then. So I wouldn't say that now I'm anywhere close to an Indiana Jones of entrepreneurship, but I'm saying that I probably was 5-10 years ago. So
Oh, thanks for sharing. You know, I know Soltara brings in a lot of entrepreneurs. I know friends of mine that have been there and certain well-known celebrities. I'm curious, you know, what is your take over the years of seeing so many people come through and step, you know, deep onto the medicine path, whether it's their first time or going for a week and just, you know, drinking a few times? How do you feel that this medicine or really any psychedelic medicine has an effect on not only entrepreneurship, but the way we do business in the world on a larger scale? Like, do you believe that there might be, you know, a shift into how we're doing business? You know, like what we're seeing with, let's say, Aubrey Marcus or Charles Eisenstein and the gift economy, or bringing more consciousness, or let's say, you know, leaders in implementing, like David Bronner, you know, his work, bringing in more sustainability into their business. Do you believe that ayahuasca is maybe helping facilitate this change, or is this my projection of my own internal dream?
I think to a certain extent, yeah. It certainly was very essential to my own development as an entrepreneur and to a lot of decisions I made in the beginning. I got a lot of my ideas and foresight during ayahuasca ceremonies. I hesitate to go too far down the rabbit hole because I've also had a bunch of ceremonies that gave me ideas that were complete BS. So, you know, it's like kind of take it with a grain of salt. But a lot of the decisions I made, especially in the beginning when I was becoming ayahuasca certainly helped me develop into the I am. And I've certainly seen it impact a lot of people in perhaps a certain similar way. And I think it's easy, especially when you get super clear. Like sometimes you can't unsee something. Right. So if you have a vision where it's like it helps you come to a very deep realization about something inside of you, about something outside of you, about something you want, about something you don't want, about something you see as important or unimportant. That sometimes creates a tectonic shift inside of you, and you must follow that wisdom or that intuition. I do shy away from leaning too heavily on ayahuasca for decision making, especially now because I feel more integrated now between life experience and medicine experience and entrepreneurial experience. I don't actually drink a lot of ayahuasca anymore because I kind of find myself like just getting like kind of repetition these days. So I don't feel the same calling to do it. And I feel like that's probably a good thing. Like, you know, you don't really want to have to keep going back to the well in order to maintain your life, right? Like you kind of want to graduate. And I mean, I always found ayahuasca to be something that really helped me get over a big maturation phase in my life. And I certainly have seen that with other people. I can't speak for, you know, I can't speak for Aubrey or for Charles or anyone else, but I've certainly observed them having creative ideas and making decisions about business moves that were based on their, I think, general broad medicine experience.
Yeah. And you bring up a really good point, which is true. I do believe in this idea of integration and that it's not here for us to just depend on. You know, it's interesting. There's people now leading these like intentional medicine ceremonies that are all about like, we're going to find business ideas and solve your business problems and, you know, scale your startup here with this ayahuasca retreat, which is, of course, you know, it's earned some criticism. And it's also, you know, yeah, there's a time and place. And I've learned personally to take everything with a grain of salt, meaning before I act on anything, and thankfully that was since day one, I you know, sit on it. I get curious. I see if it's really real. I feel into it in my reality and not just in the medicine space. And then, hey, maybe 2 to 3 years later, it actually manifests. But let's talk a little also about integration. How does Solterra do or offer integration as part of the retreats? And then I think you guys also do have a separate like integration community being built, right? From what I understand.
Yeah. So that's not really my specialty. That was not part of the game when I got into the game, really. And that was, I'll blame Melissa, our COO, for really understanding that that was a big vacuum that needed to be filled. And then, you know, so that was a collaboration between psychologists and artists and medicine people and to really create our integration journal and then a version 2 of that integration journal. And then, you know, integrating Western psychologists who also have a lot of medicine experience to have, you know, phone calls and consultations. And then on top of that, yeah. So my co-founder Melissa also built this, along with Sylvia Bringus, our, digital marketer and a friend. She's been with us for a long time. Actually started coming down when I lived in Peru. They built this integration community called the Maloca. And it's a very interesting concept. I've been in support of it since they brought it to me. It's you know, they offer all different kinds of sessions with different types of practitioners, community. You know, you can like meet the people that you're going to go on retreat with, even, you know, 6 months in advance, and start developing relationships and follow up relationships and all kinds of stuff. Again, it's constantly evolving and they're constantly innovating in that community, and it's doing better. It's, you know, it's constantly getting more traction and getting more members. And yeah, we're just, you know, trying to stay kind of ahead of the curve there in that aspect, because yeah, that was if you were into the medicine kind of around the same time when I got into it, you know, it was a lot more Wild West. It was like, you know, you, it was crazy. Yeah, it was like,
there was
crazy.
The word integration didn't really exist
back then. Right. It was like, it was all about the experience. It was you go down, you have this big experience, and that's going to change your life. And then you know, people started realizing that, okay, well, you can go and have this big experience, and then sometimes it doesn't change your life. Sometimes you just go back to old patterns and old ways of being, old relationships. And we've actually just approved an interesting concept, which is like integration for relationships in your life. So support for people. So when you go and have these big experiences and put all this time into your integration, and then you go home to the same relationships in the same situations, you can actually prep those people for, you know, how to be supportive of your integration and how to perhaps learn from you from your own processes when you actually get back. So that's kind of a new area that we're exploring right now. But yeah, the ultimate goal is to maximize benefit, right? So if you're going to invest in, you know, in an expensive trip down to Peru or Costa Rica or Brazil or, you know, anywhere else, you want to actually come away with something positive and that's lasting. I find it weird, those guys who are doing these entrepreneurial retreats. It struck me as like, you know, you can kind of have an intention, but you also have to just let anything that needs to come up, come up. So I don't know, like I wouldn't want to, you know, I have had business ideas come up during ceremonies, but like, I wouldn't want to be like, okay, I'm going to drink ayahuasca and figure out what I need to do about Q3 earnings this year, you know?
And I actually have a theory that it wouldn't tell you what to do anyways. It's like the name of this podcast, which by the way is really medicine for these times. It's The Psychedelic Entrepreneur, was because algorithms. But the real name is Medicine for These Times, and it came through a ceremony and I was like, wow, that's amazing. I think I'm going to call my podcast this. Let me sit on it. And I sat on it until, you know, 6 months later, I was like, okay, then there's this thing called algorithms and I probably need to give it, like, because someone told me that it's going to get categorized in the medicine, like the actual, you know, traditional healthcare and medicine. I was like, oh. But yeah, like it's the same thing where I'm like, oh, it just came through. Let me sit on it, you know, see if I like it in a few more months when I'm actually launching this. And then, you know, we'll see. But yeah, I find it interesting, and who knows, like maybe one day I'll actually go in and try to see like, okay, I'm going to make this whole ceremony about the next thing I'm launching, and I'll just launch whatever it tells me to do. See what happens. But nah. I agree, you know, to each their own. That's kind of the way I approach all this. But speaking of, you know, I like this idea of preparing other people in your life and integrating. That's a big deal because, you know, we've all seen people come back and maybe announce something big. It's like they say, don't quit your job, don't leave your relationship, like actually take time to integrate. But what else is on the table for either you or Solterra, or, you know, like what are you bringing out into the world this year? Like what are your big plans for the next year, 2 years, or, you know, expansion?
Well, if people don't already think I'm weird, the big thing I'm doing right now is launching a heavy metal band. So, you know, the Solterra. Okay. So Solterra, yes, we're growing at a snail's pace. You know, we're not trying to stress ourselves out too much, not trying to put ourselves at too much risk, you know, in the business, but we do have a lot of demand. So, you know, we're trying to serve people when and where we can, but in a certain way, that's just always value add. So for example, we are working on a place we haven't announced yet, so I'm not going to talk in specifics about it, but we started basically doing rentals. So renting long-term rentals in a place, and that kind of adds to our repertoire of locations, experiences. So, you know, beachfront or Amazon or perhaps other locations that add something to the roster, and we can still apply our techniques you know, this just makes sure things are done right in a way that people have come to trust us for, and make sure people are able to have their work with the medicine and come away with some value add. But that's going, you know, I'm not crazy involved right now. I mean, I kind of guide the ship a little bit, but you know, over the years we've built a really strong team that is committed to the mission, and Melissa's taking on more and more roles, and I think at some point she'll be ready to take the helm of the ship. And you know, I'm 41 now, and I've gone from seeking adventure in South America, to seeking comfort in South America, to seeking being a rock star and traveling the world and playing live in front of people. So, so we are launching our second album this year. It's going really well. Our most recent single has just been absolutely crushing it on streaming and views. And we got a record deal, which is helping us out a lot. We've got tour dates coming up this year. So we're going to be touring South America. I literally thought I would never go back to Peru, but we're going back to Peru to play a concert, which is kind of crazy.
In Lima.
Yeah. And, Argentina, Chile, Colombia, Brazil, Ecuador. And then we're going, to Europe in April and May, to Germany, Denmark, Netherlands, Belgium to play shows. And we'll be definitely doing some more touring later on in the year, the U.S. So, yeah, I mean, that's just kind of like the exciting thing I'm working on right now. And that's the startup battle. You know, we're constantly trying to figure out how to get, you know, new tour opportunities and keep the band alive and crack the promotion code and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah. And I got a couple of puppy dogs, couple of huskies, and that's all keeping me pretty busy.
Well, Daniel, it was an honor to meet you and bring you here and to hear your story and share all of these realities of opening a retreat center and just this this adventure of entrepreneurship. I appreciate it. And thank you so much for the amazing work that you've been doing in the world.
Thank you, Beth. I appreciate the opportunity. Good luck with what you're doing as well.
I hope you enjoyed the episode. If you're feeling inspired, I'd appreciate it if you showed your love with a review. And check out my YouTube channel where you can find the video version of this podcast. You can also head to bethaweinstein.com to learn more about me and grab my free business growth trainings. Remember, you carry your own unique medicine, and your medicine is what we need for these times.